I next met with Dr. David Spiegel, who presented the data on the monoclonal antibody MetMab in non-small cell lung cancer at ASCO, and we started our conversation by chatting about this fascinating agent.
MetMab is an antibody that targets the MET receptor. There are several drugs in development now that are going after the MET pathway, but this is the first antibody that's targeting the receptor. The study that we've recently presented was a randomized phase 2 study really designed to look at unselected patients and combining MetMab with erlotinib in one group of patients and erlotinib and placebo in the other group. This was a randomized phase 2 placebo-controlled trial. There were 137 patients enrolled in this study. All patients had advanced non-small cell lung cancer and all histologies were acceptable. Patients had received one or two prior lines of systemic therapy. Patients were then stratified based on histology, smoking status, and performance status, and were randomized 1:1 to either receive MetMab at a dose of 15 milligrams per kilogram IV every 3 weeks in combination with erlotinib at the standard dosing schedule of 150 milligrams orally daily, or placebo in combination with erlotinib. One interesting aspect of this study was crossover was allowed for the control group, and indeed about 27 patients did cross over at progression where they continued erlotinib and had MetMab added. This trial had two primary endpoints. Both were looking at progression-free survival, one in the overall intent to treat or so-called unselected population, and then progression-free survival in a predefined group of patients that we'll call MET diagnostic positive. Again, this trial enrolled about 137 patients across the world and included Europe, Australia, and the United States. The patients that ended up getting enrolled in this trial split pretty evenly between MET diagnostic positive and MET diagnostic negative, and I'll just take a moment to explain that for you. So again, all patients who entered this trial could have had any histology regardless of MET expression. It was anticipated that MET expression by immunohistochemistry was pretty ubiquitous, and that if you looked at the patients who had the strongest expression and compared that with a group of patients who had weaker expression, it would probably divide out approximately 50-50. So a definition of MET diagnostic positive was created. And this defined patients who had at least 50% of the tumor specimen expressing moderate or strong staining by IHC, kind of using the old 2-3+ scoring system. As it turned out, 52% of patients ended up scoring in the diagnostic positive subgroup. Now remember, all patients on this trial were allowed on regardless of MET expression, but the diagnostic category that patients were assigned to was defined prior to unblinding of the data. So patients' scores were looked at before the data were analyzed. All patients had to have tissue to get on this trial. And if you look at all the samples that were submitted, so that could have been approximately a dozen unstained slides or a tissue block, paraffin-embedded tissue block, about 93% of those samples were usable. You could assess IHC for looking at diagnostic scoring. As it turned out, the 52% of patients who were MET diagnostic positive, this gets kind of complicated without looking at a slide, but if you look at the patients who were MET diagnostic positive, and remember they get split into patients who were treated with MetMab and erlotinib and patients who were treated with placebo and erlotinib, so the numbers, of course, get smaller. The baseline characteristics were pretty well balanced. Most of these patients had non-squamous tumors. Most of these patients had good performance status. Additional analyses were performed retrospectively looking at things like KRAS mutation status, EGFR mutation status, and those actually balanced out. So about 20% of patients in the MET diagnostic positive group were KRAS positive who were treated with placebo or treated with MetMab. And that number was about 10% for EGFR activating mutations. If you look at the group of patients who were MET diagnostic negative, again, split into each cohort of patients who received MetMab and erlotinib and patients who received placebo and erlotinib. Again, the baseline characteristics were balanced. If you compare, though, the diagnostic negative group as a whole with the diagnostic positive group as a whole, there were probably more smokers and more squamous tumors in that subgroup. That's perhaps important to keep in mind as you look at the data. So those are the baseline characteristics, pretty well balanced, pretty consistent with other second line, third line studies with erlotinib, such as BR21, which probably had a little bit worse group of patients with ECOG-3 performance status than this trial, but in general, what we'd expect in refractory group of patients. So just moving ahead, looking at the results, again, remember this trial had two co-primary endpoints, so one looking at the overall intent to treat population. If you look at PFS in the overall intent to treat population, actually the curves for each cohort lie pretty much on top of each other. That is to say, there is no advantage for MetMab and erlotinib compared with placebo or erlotinib. For PFS, the hazard ratio is basically one. For overall survival, that's true as well. So I think had the study been stopped right there, I guess you and I probably wouldn't be talking. This would be another example of a small randomized phase two study that was negative. But when you look at the results by MET diagnostic subgroups, that's where the results were somewhat interesting, although keeping in mind this was a small study. So when looking at the group of patients who were MET diagnostic positive for progression-free survival, actually there was an advantage in favor of MetMab and erlotinib compared with placebo or erlotinib. And really the hazard ratio, I think, defines that best. That was 0.5. And what was a bit of a surprise is if you look at overall survival, again, the hazard ratio favors MetMab with a hazard ratio of 0.4. So that was a bit of a surprise that a PFS would translate into a consistent story there with survival. What I think is as interesting is if you look at the MET diagnostic negative subgroup, remembering that the overall intent to treat population, the curves overlapped each other, and there was a split in favor of MetMab in the diagnostic positive group. So the opposite was true for the MET diagnostic negative group. That is to say, patients who received MetMab and erlotinib in the negative cohort actually had a worse progression-free survival and a worse overall survival. Keeping in mind the numbers are small and all the caveats of a randomized phase two, but the hazard ratios favored placebo. So for progression-free survival, that was a hazard ratio of 1.8, and for overall survival, the same hazard ratio of 1.8. So therein, you know, is the somewhat interesting findings that looking back at the patients who were scored by immunohistochemistry in the strong or moderate staining group, there was an advantage for MetMab. But if you were a patient that had 0 or 1+ staining, and most of the patients actually had 1+ staining in that cohort, there was actually a disadvantage to receiving MetMab and erlotinib. I didn't mention response rates. Actually, there was no real signal there in terms of response rates. The response rates, regardless of diagnostic subgroup or treatment, was basically a little under 5%. The toxicity was very surprising and reassuring. There was no excess toxicity for MetMab except for edema. So there was peripheral edema, which was largely low-grade and reversible. But there were a couple of patients reported who actually had generalized edema, which was serious. But I've noted, just looking at some other work, that that appears to be a class effect of these drugs. So again, largely low-grade, largely reversible. The other toxicities seen in the study were what we'd expect with erlotinib: rash, diarrhea, fatigue, and there did not seem to be any imbalances based on MetMab exposure. So from a safety standpoint, I think that was pretty reassuring. And the results are, I guess, enticing, I'd say. You know, these studies, you know better than anyone, are done to look for signals. And I think a signal was found here, which now is leading to the start of a randomized phase three prospective study.
So I've got about 50 questions to ask you, but first, maybe we can start back with the actual pathways involved here and also what the thinking was in combining it with erlotinib.
So the MET pathway is another pathway that has been, I guess, rigorously studied now for many years. And actually, I credit Dr. Ravi Salgiya with doing a lot of this work. He's really helped us all better understand this pathway, but a lot of credit goes to a lot of other folks. You know, MET is a receptor that has downstream signals that stimulate cell-cell discohesion, that stimulates metastases. Actually, there's a connection to angiogenesis as well. So disrupting this pathway has been a goal for drug development. And I think you may know that many drugs are in development to target this pathway, either by targeting the receptor or targeting its ligand, which is HGF or hepatocyte growth factor. And indeed, there are companies that have developed an antibody, for example, that targets HGF. MetMab targets the receptor. And then probably most of the development right now is with small molecule inhibitors that are targeting the receptor itself. The pathway, there are many aberrations in the receptor that can occur. So amplification has been described, mutations have been described, and then overexpression, as I was getting to with the MetMAB trial. Also, HGF itself can be overproduced, so there are paracrine and autocrine examples of overproduction of that ligand. If you look at mutations, though, and you look at amplification, actually the rates are pretty low. So just looking across the board in non-small cell lung cancers, that's going to be a pretty low prevalence of a target for patients. You know, probably less than 5% of patients are going to have what I would say targetable or druggable mutations or amplifications. One interesting story that several folks, including Jeff Engelman at Mass General, have helped show is that MET may be implicated in the development of resistance to tyrosine kinase inhibitors in patients with EGFR activating mutations. So Jeff reported in kind of a pivotal paper that perhaps 20% of resistance can be explained that way, although I've seen more recent presentations suggesting that rate may be lower. But nonetheless, it probably is an important mechanism of resistance to drugs like erlotinib and gefitinib. Primary or initial resistance to EGFR targeting drugs is probably pretty rare. So targeting this pathway up front to try to prevent resistance from drugs like erlotinib is probably going to have a low chance of success in terms of trying to target a resistance pathway. But there is reason to combine these drugs. So there are preclinical models where MetMAB has demonstrated activity across multiple solid tumors, including lung cancer. And actually in a model with erlotinib, where cells are sensitive to erlotinib, you can show that that sensitivity is lost in the presence of HGF. And when you add MetMAB, you can restore that sensitivity to erlotinib. So that's a cell line model where there's rationale combining MetMAB with erlotinib. And then there are transgenic mouse models where the combination of erlotinib and MetMAB leads to greater cell death than either agent alone, probably a little less than what we'd call synergy, but probably at least additive benefits there. So there are some preclinical models that provide rationale for combining these drugs. I think the genesis of this trial was recognizing that erlotinib is an established drug for the treatment of non-small cell lung cancer in the refractory setting, and here was a new drug that perhaps has at least additive activity when combined with erlotinib. And I think the goal here was to add it to the standard of care and see if it could improve outcomes.
Of course, a lot of times trials are developed and then we learn more things and kind of rethink it. But as you think about it today, and I'm curious what the design of the phase 3 study is, if there is one yet, would you expect that the erlotinib-MetMAB combination would be effective in EGFR mutation positive, negative, or both?
Well, I think, you know, that's a great question. I mean, the bottom line is we don't know. In this trial, there were about 13 patients who had EGFR activating mutations, and the numbers are quite small when you split them out based on diagnostic subgroups and then who got MetMAB, who got placebo. What I can tell you is when you take all those patients out, the advantage still is in favor of MetMAB and erlotinib. So we know that that's not necessary for benefit. But to answer your question, would patients do better who had EGFR activating mutations who received erlotinib plus this? We just don't know the answer to that. There is a prospective randomized phase 3 study that is in development and hopefully by year's end will be underway. And that's a trial that's going to be focused in patients who are MET diagnostic positive. So the design basically is the same as the randomized phase 2, the difference being that patients will be selected up front for diagnostic positivity.
And again, EGFR mutation positive and negative?
Well, so that's a source of continued debate here, but I think you recognize the arguments for and against leaving those patients in. It's thought overall with a prevalence in at least a Western population of 10 to 12% that in a large randomized study that if you allow those patients to enroll in this trial, it's unlikely that there's going to be enough patients there to really skew or confound the data. I think the latest kind of iteration is to allow patients with mutations to go on, but to identify those patients up front so that their stratification is appropriate.
And you said that, quote, there has been activity demonstrated of MetMAB before. Is that as monotherapy? Have the responses been observed?
Well, actually, so Ravi Saljia conducted a phase 1 study with MetMAB as a single agent, and to be fair, there were no dramatic responses except in one patient who had a gastric cancer who was heavily pretreated. And I think you may know gastric cancers are one of the tumors which probably have a lot of HGF signaling, perhaps autocrine signaling. And so there was a signal there in that patient. There were very few patients with lung cancer on that. And so response rates were not seen in general as a whole.
Now, you also reported on FISH studies of CMET.
Right. So, you know, others, I'm thinking of Federico Capuzzo, have published data on MET expression by fish and have reported that these rates are quite low. Again, well below 10%, probably closer to 5 to 7%, and associated with worse prognosis in patients. Additional work was done on this trial. I've talked to you about MET expression by IHC, EGFR analyses for activating mutations, KRAS analyses for mutations. But additional work was also done looking at MET amplification by fish. So I think some interesting findings there. And just to note, this was presented, we just got back from Amsterdam and presented kind of an update on this. If you look at patients who had MET amplification by fish, the numbers are quite small. And there is an advantage for MetMab in those patients. So MetMab and erlotinib compared with placebo and erlotinib. But when you look at patients who are fish negative, which was most of the patients, as long as they had MET diagnostic positivity, they benefited from the combination. So that kind of suggests that despite amplification, ligand interaction with the receptor is probably still relevant because the antibody's role is at that level, is blocking HGF stimulation of the receptor. So even in an amplified tumor or an unamplified tumor, that interaction seems to be relevant.
Now, you mentioned that the MET negative group actually did worse. Any speculation about why? I mean, can you envision some kind of counteractive or, you know, negative impact of the drug? Or, of course, you mentioned the possibility of numbers or some other interaction.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest part to try to explain right now is, frankly, we don't understand why there is a negative interaction. And it's not just that patients don't benefit. It's that there's a suggestion you're harming patients. But why would that be? If we know erlotinib offers so much benefit in the negative subgroup and you have worse outcomes when you add MetMab, then the obvious connection there is that MetMab is interfering with erlotinib's activity. But what is that? We know there's a lot of crosstalk between the MET pathway and HGF signaling and the EGFR pathway. But I guess to be frank about it, we still don't quite understand why MetMab would cause a negative interaction. It may have something to do with dependence on the pathway, but we still don't understand that. It was felt overall, though, that with the signal seen, despite the small numbers, it's not going to be a safe route to design a phase 3 study and allow those patients to go on. I think MetMab and other drugs targeting this pathway should continue to be explored in a number of solid tumors, and I think we shouldn't discount those drugs' roles in patients who have MET-negative tumors until those studies have been done. I mean, for example, at our center, we're about to launch a study in advanced colorectal cancer. My colleague, Dr. Johanna Bendel, is leading that study. But in that trial, she's not limiting patients based on MET diagnostic status. In fact, it's being designed in the way that the lung trial was. So retrospectively, you go back and try to figure that out.
You mentioned the edema, which is kind of interesting. Can you draw out more how this monoclonal antibody might cause edema?
Well, I'm afraid I've talked to Ravi Salji about that. Just not clear. We know that inhibition of the pathway is involved in the production of interstitial fluid, but we don't quite understand why that occurs in some patients and why it's localized in some patients, for example, in the lower extremities. And we have other patients, in fact, two on the study, who developed more of an anasarca picture. So not just lower extremity edema, but even things like pleural effusions, periorbital edema. You know, it doesn't appear to be a hypersensitivity reaction. It appears to be a true effect of third spacing, but it's just not clear. But it has been reported in other drugs that target this pathway. I'm familiar with, for example, crizotinib, which of course is being developed to inhibit ALK inversions, translocations, that's been seen as well. So I think more work needs to be done. It's an interesting association in terms of what it's hitting and why it's causing it to be more generalized in some patients. I do want to note, though, even though it's rare and largely reversible, I have seen a couple of patients who've had serious generalized edema that their care had to be adjusted to deal with that. So I don't want to minimize it because the rare patient, it can still be an issue.
It's really interesting. I never heard that about crizotinib. So you can see.
Well, I don't want to misspeak. Obviously, Alice Shaw and Ross Kamage and others have run those trials. So I've only been privy to the data like everyone else has. And I've heard reports of edema, peripheral edema. I know it's not a reason not to use the drug, but certainly something that's been seen.
It's really fascinating. Does crizotinib affect the MET pathway too?
Well, yeah, you know, again, I don't claim to be an expert on crizotinib's development, but the drug was initially designed to target the MET pathway as a small molecule inhibitor, and the ALK story was seen somewhat serendipitously, but because crizotinib is approved for the treatment of ALK conversions, translocations, I think technically we'd have to say it's going to be the first MET inhibitor on the market, even though obviously it's not going to be labeled or approved to be used to target patients with MET-positive tumors. I think those studies are being planned or going to have to be done in the near future.
So before we get into your cases, one more ASCO paper that you were part of that I'm curious about. You don't hear too much about small cell nowadays.
Yeah.
There was a phase 3 study looking at amrubicin versus topotecan as second-line treatment for small cell. Can you comment on that?
I guess I have mixed feelings about that study because, you know, I've personally been very interested in small cell lung cancer, and in our center, we've tried to always have a number of trials in that setting. And so when amrubicin was kind of showing itself in the Japanese population, an area where amrubicin is already approved for the treatment of lung cancer with high response rates, not only in patients with relapse-sensitive disease, but really refractory disease, some reports of response rates as high as 50% in that population. You know, this generated a lot of enthusiasm, certainly on my part, but also other investigators who were wanting to work with amrubicin. So we were all very hopeful that this was going to lead to really an advance in the treatment of small cell lung cancer. Amrubicin is essentially a novel anthracycline. I think what distinguishes it from drugs like adriamycin is that it doesn't appear to have any, at least immediate or short-term, cardiac toxicity. So, Neil, as you point out, a randomized phase 3 study was presented at ASCO and was also presented again at World Lung in Amsterdam. This was all based on a randomized phase 2 study that showed that amrubicin compared with topotecan had a high response rate in patients with sensitive relapse disease. And David Ettinger published a cohort of patients who had refractory disease, were treated with amrubicin, who had high response rate as well. Remember, that group of patients were lucky if we see response rates above 5%. So a randomized phase 3 study was conducted in patients with relapse small cell lung cancer, and actually patients with sensitive relapse disease, refractory relapse disease, could enroll. And it's important to remember that point. Patients were randomized to either amrubicin, a 3-day schedule, or topotecan, given the 5-day schedule, which I think you know, Neil, is not probably the most popular schedule in the treatment of small cell, much less ovarian cancer. I mean, most doctors tend to use an altered schedule. Nonetheless, that was the kind of requirement because that's the FDA labeled use of topotecan. So that trial was conducted around the world, and we have the results now presented, which were basically disappointing. The goal of the study was to show an advantage in terms of survival for all the patients combined, and there was no survival advantage for amrubicin compared with topotecan. If you look at the subgroups, though, so the patients who had sensitive relapse, the patients who had refractory relapse, there was indeed an advantage not only for response rate, but progression-free survival and overall survival in the refractory group of patients. But because the study was designed with an overall survival outcome and the overall intent-to-treat group, you know, I think we have to technically say this was a negative study. Whether this drug finds its way into the treatment of refractory small cell lung cancer in the U.S. or in Europe or elsewhere, I think, remains to be seen. But the bottom line is the drug was very active in a Japanese cohort of patients, appeared to be active in a phase 2 setting in a Western population, but proved not to be true in a randomized phase 3 setting.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about your patients, beginning with your 37-year-old. Maybe you can just talk a little bit about how the patient presented.
Yeah, this is an interesting gentleman, a 37-year-old gentleman actually from Kentucky, who basically presented with a cough and some weight loss as well as pretty bad back pain, and went to his primary care physician, ultimately referred for imaging, which revealed lesions throughout the spine and multiple pulmonary lesions. This gentleman is an employee of a car manufacturer and works in welding. That's the only part of his history that may be relevant. He's a non-smoker, no exposure otherwise at work or in his family. And otherwise, for a 37-year-old, what we'd expect to be perfectly healthy. So to make, I guess, a long story short, he had a biopsy performed of a lung lesion, which confirmed adenocarcinoma. And to the physician's credit at the original institution, the tumor was profiled for RAS, for EGFR, for ALK, and basically everything came back negative, which, you know, was a bit of not only a disappointment, but somewhat of a surprise, and somebody was a non-smoker, although the welding perhaps is the, you know, might be the trigger in him. He was treated by his original doctor with standard chemotherapy, that being carboplatin and pemetrexed. He did not receive bevacizumab, but he did well for a while. His pain got better, and he's been receiving actually denosumab from that physician. He came to us 6 or 8 months ago looking for other options after disease had progressed. And so he actually is pursuing currently a phase one option at our trial. Just, I don't want to get too far off subject here, but he's receiving weekly paclitaxel in combination with a dual mTOR inhibitor. And I'll just say that he's doing well right now. But I don't present him now because of that phase one experience. I present him because of the frustration that, you know, you find yourself in when you have a young patient. You hope to be able to give them good news when you find out they're a non-smoker that, you know, maybe there's a 30 or 40% chance they'll have an activating mutation and you can give them something like erlotinib. But in this gentleman who really had a full profile done, there were other markers looked at, nothing seemed to be a target for him. And I find these patients to be the most complicated and challenging to care for. In fact, just today, I have another gentleman I share with, William Powell at Vanderbilt, and I think you may know of William's work. William's done a lot of full sequencing of this gentleman's tumor, and like my patient here, a young guy, non-smoker, but they share in common that there was nothing there in their profile that we could target, and that's frustrating because, unfortunately, you're left with somewhat standard treatments, just like we do for patients with squamous cancer at this point.
How do you generally approach patients who have EGFR wild metastatic adenocarcinoma in terms of chemo, bevacizumab, and maintenance?
Well, I guess the quick answer is we try to get them on a trial. But outside of a clinical trial, when the results come back negative for EGFR and ALK negative, because those are the two tests I routinely do in all my patients with non-squamous tumors. And outside of a trial, you know, I think you look towards standard chemotherapy. I've been very impressed with carboplatin and pemetrexed, perhaps not because of its great efficacy, but I don't believe it's truly a better regimen than, say, carboplatin and paclitaxel necessarily, but I think it's easier. And so I find myself more and more using that up front, carboplatin and pemetrexed. And, you know, we participated in the study, which I think jokingly gets referred to as the Patel versus Sandler regimen of ECOG 4599's carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab versus carboplatin pemetrexed and bevacizumab. We're waiting on those results. That trial is fully enrolled. But, you know, we had many patients go on that study and found that to be not only well tolerated, but at least in our small experience, appears to be as active as anything else. But we ultimately are waiting on those results to see if it makes sense to give patients bevacizumab. Personally, I kind of go back and forth. I have some patients I discuss bevacizumab with all patients, but I have some patients I'll go ahead and give it with pemetrexed and carboplatin. I think the tough part for me is, what do I do after four cycles? Do I stop and give PEM and BEV? Do I stop and just give PEM? Do I stop and just give BEV? Or do I stop altogether? And I can tell you I've done all those scenarios based on patient preference and how they're doing overall. It's a big commitment to tell someone to stay on PEM and BEV for every 3 weeks indefinitely. But, you know, that may be the way we're going, but I think we have to wait until those results are final.
Yeah, and I guess that's the Point Break trial that you're referring to.
Right,
that's going to look at, I think it's looking both at the upfront question as well as this sort of maintenance type of question.
Yeah, you know, like every physician, I think it's gotten complicated, right? These drugs are out there, and to know the best way to use them, I didn't even mention erlotinib in the maintenance setting or switch therapy to something like docetaxel. I think in general, I'm a believer that switch is probably just that. It's probably not maintenance therapy. It's early second line treatment. The tougher question, I think, is drugs like PEM and bevacizumab that you continue on, and what is the timeline to those drugs?
You know, I meant to ask you before when you were talking about your trial looking at squamous cell, any thoughts about nab-paclitaxel? There were some data presented last year and then this year at ASCO from Mark Sosinski. There's been some thought or suggestion that maybe there's a particular benefit in squamous cell. What are your thoughts about that?
I tell you, I've had an interesting view on nab-paclitaxel. To be fair, I wasn't initially very enamored with the data that came out in breast cancer from that randomized trial versus docetaxel. And then, you know, the drug got approved, and I see my colleagues use that, although the use appeared to be slow. And then it's not approved in lung cancer, but has a compendia listing. And so, you know, I've had a chance to start using in some refractory patients, and I've been surprised by not only how easy it is to give to patients, but that I see a lot of disease control. So what you're referring to is Mark Sosinski presented at ASCO, and I'm not sure if this was updated in Amsterdam, the results of a randomized phase 3 study first presented last year, but the survival data were updated. This was a pretty simple study, I guess what we call a vanilla trial of carboplatin and nab-paclitaxel versus carboplatin and paclitaxel, a huge study over 1,000 patients, worldwide trial. But here was the interesting thing about this trial is the primary endpoint of this study was response rate. And indeed, there was an advantage in favor of nab-paclitaxel for response rate. Now, Mark just presented the survival data, and there was no advantage for survival, although it's worth pointing out the control arm did quite well for carboplatin and paclitaxel. So here you have a positive phase 3 study with a primary endpoint of response rate. And my understanding is that that was a trial that was designed with a special protocol assessment. So will this drug get approved and officially labeled in the treatment of lung cancer? It seems that it probably will. What you point out is that there were some interesting subset analyses looked at, and one was in patients with squamous cancer, one was in patients who were elderly. You know, I think that obviously becomes problematic when you start doing all these subset analyses, but whether this drug is better in patients with squamous cancer, I just can't understand why it would be. But there was a signal there, and certainly a lot of folks move on signals like that. Whether this drug is going to move into another first-line trial in squamous patients, maybe squamous elderly patients, I don't know, but certainly the drug probably got a little momentum from these recent findings. The other thing about this drug, you know, just in my experience, my gut feeling is this is a drug that probably offers you the same kind of activity that you'd see with any second, third line single agent drug, but probably is pretty well tolerated, maybe better tolerated than docetaxel, who knows. But it's a drug that folks can stay on, and, you know, if they don't mind coming to the office on a weekly basis, it's a pretty quick infusion and it seems to be well tolerated. So I've had several patients who've actually done quite well with disease control, but whether this drug's really going to find its way into standard first-line treatment and become a backbone for things like bevacizumab or other biologic agents, I think it's just hard to see that happening.
Can you talk a little bit about this 63-year-old woman?
Yeah, she makes me laugh. I just left her this past week and had met her. That was the second visit. The first visit, I think I was either the second or third opinion. She's a very bright woman, 63-year-old, with a perfect medical history, non-smoker, who actually has this great family, two sisters that are very holistic in their thoughts on treatments. Anyway, to make a long story short, she had a T2N1 stage 2A cancer that was resected. So I'm seeing her now in the adjuvant setting. So she was already reluctant to come to me because, as a lot of patients who, once they have surgery, really aren't so interested in getting additional treatment because I think the hope is that it's gone. So what's interesting about her care is not only her adjuvant recommendations for the presence of an EGFR activating mutation, and she ended up having an L858R mutation. And again, she's pretty bright, knowledgeable. Her sisters certainly are as well. And so they came in with a load of questions about why can't they just get gefitinib or erlotinib? So she's been complicated because, number one, I've talked to her about her risk for recurrence and recommendations for systemic adjuvant chemotherapy. We have two clinical trials here that she's a candidate for. So that's one part of the discussion. And then the other part of the discussion is, should she get a drug like erlotinib and gefitinib? And, you know, I was open with her and told her the answer to that is no right now, or I should say it's unknown, although I have colleagues who do this, who give the drug around the country, who recommend a drug like erlotinib following or with chemotherapy. I think what was kind of sobering were the results that were presented a little over a year ago in patients, an NCIC study, I think Dr. Goss was the first author, where patients were randomized after adjuvant treatment to gefitinib or not, or placebo. And I know this study was relatively small, but not only was there no advantage in favor of gefitinib, but when you actually looked at the patients who had EGFR activating mutations, and the numbers get pretty small, there was a suggestion of perhaps the opposite being true. I don't know if you saw this, Neil, but perhaps patients could be harmed. Now, does that apply to erlotinib? Is that a subset analysis that is steering us in the wrong direction? Francis Shepard is leading a large randomized phase 3 study called the RADIANT trial using erlotinib. And in that study, and we participated in that trial, in that study, patients could receive chemotherapy or not in the adjuvant setting. And then patients are randomized 2-1, as I recall, to erlotinib or placebo. That trial is finished enrollment. And my understanding is that trial is coming near an interim analysis. So I think technically I have to say we don't know, but I'll have to admit, I got that question where, what would you do if it was your family member? And I looked at her and said, you know, I probably would recommend it at this point. I probably would think about giving her erlotinib, but I'd be quick to stop it if the interim analysis suggested otherwise. So, you know, really an interesting, challenging situation where you're trying to use the best information you have to date and make the best decision for a patient, but certainly don't want to harm them.
You mentioned that you had trials that she might have been eligible for. What are they looking at?
Well, one is, you know, that really impressive sponsor study using the MAGE, M-A-G-E. We're not supposed to use the term vaccine, but that's the way I describe it to patients. And in that trial, patients are randomized to the vaccine or placebo. And again, chemotherapy is an option. And actually, as it turns out, this patient, she's agreed to allow us to at least screen her for the presence of this MAGE protein. That's a pretty exciting study. I think almost 11,000 patients have been screened with the goal of enrolling a little over 2,000 patients. And I think that trial is expected to finally finish enrollment around November. So that's of interest. We actually have a pilot study with docetaxel, carboplatin, bevacizumab, and erlotinib. That trial I designed, boy, maybe 3 or 4 years ago before 1505 got started. And we're just now about to close that trial. It's taken us several years to get a little under 200 patients on that trial. That was really meant to be a trial to look at safety and kind of get a pilot experience of using bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting. But I think you all know the definitive trial is Heather Wakely's intergroup study with bevacizumab we're waiting on.
Right, that's the 1505 ECOG study you were referring to. How do you approach the issue of choice of chemotherapy, and what did you recommend to this woman?
So you need to remember, I work with guys like Tony Greco and John Haynesworth, and so I don't get into the cisplatin, carboplatin debate.
I was going to say, I think I know what's coming.
So what's interesting, and I don't know if you attended that last day oral session at ASCO, but there was a kind of a pilot experience of cisplatin fenorelbine versus cisplatin pemetrexed in the adjuvant setting.
Right. I was going to ask you about that, actually.
Yeah, it was really impressive. I mean, it's, to my knowledge, it's the first adjuvant data set. I mean, it's small, but the first adjuvant data set comparing what, you know, is the so-called standard cisplatin fenorelbine with what might be considered the most modern regimen, cisplatin pemetrexed. And I was impressed by the wide splitting of the curves. And to me, that at least showed there's some activity and safety. And I always remember that the ECOG 1505 study had added as one of its possible regimens you could choose a pemetrexed-based regimen. So I actually talked with this patient a great deal, and I went through all, you know, I do usually use a carboplatin paclitaxel regimen in the adjuvant setting, but I actually suggested she consider pemetrexed and carboplatin. And with all the caveats about lack of data, doesn't have cisplatin in it, and et cetera, but I thought that would be a very reasonable regimen for her. No maintenance therapy, just 4 cycles.
My take on that paper you were referring to was it was smaller, but it was mainly looking at toxicity.
Right.
And it seemed like more than 95% of the patients were able to get the cis-pem, whereas maybe 75% actually got the cis-fenorelbine. So I guess in terms of tolerability, there was a big difference. Does that sort of sync up with your observations?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I've only used PEM in probably less than 5 patients in the adjuvant setting. And it's only been after a complication where, you know, maybe an infusion reaction or some neuropathy that's come on early. I thought that to be a reasonable change in therapy. So she would be my first patient I would recommend PEM for. But, you know, I appreciate all the caveats. And I guess I tend to continue to use the family member rule. What would you do if it's one of your family members? And I think that's a very reasonable regimen for this patient. I don't want to short sell kind of what people do in the community. I mean, I certainly don't represent every community oncologist, but, you know, I find a lot of folks I talk to who are considering adjuvant therapies do use carboplatin-based regimens and do kind of different things. But I do want to point out that I know a lot of very bright, good physicians I work with who do use cisplatin and fenorelbine-based regimens. I mean, they stick to the data, and I respect them for that.
Well, certainly cis is favored by a lot of investigators. And in fact, you have to use cis on the ECOG 1505 study.
Right.
A couple other things just to finish out here that I made some notes about. You were talking about the vaccine study. How does that vaccine compare to so-called BLP vaccine?
My understanding on the STIMIVAX study is that that trial has actually finished enrollment, and I think that's limited to patients with stage 3 disease. And that'll be the pivotal trial for that agent. And I'm guessing in the next 18 months, we'll have some signal there. This mage target, unlike the Muk 1 target, is, I think, less ubiquitous. I think it's only seen in about a third of all comers, perhaps higher in stage 3 patients, lower in stage 1B patients. Is something that may be more prevalent in squamous tumors than it is in non-squamous tumors. I think what the MAGE vaccine has going for it is the randomized phase 2 study, which I understand has finally been submitted for publication, which demonstrated an advantage in terms of disease-free survival for patients that received that compared with folks that got placebo. And my understanding is this drug is not only exciting in lung cancer, but in melanoma as well, and is being studied there. So, you know, the hope is that more than one vaccine will make it into the treatment of solid tumors. But this would be a big story, I think, a big shift in the care of patients with early stage lung cancer if we ended up having a new drug that was in this vaccine category. Of course, several look exciting that are in development as well.
A couple other quick questions about new compounds. We were talking before about EGFR mutations, erlotinib, gefitinib. Any comments about the irreversible EGFR TKIs? And the one I think we've heard the most about is afatinib.
Right. I think that, you know, you wonder if these drugs just were being developed 10 years ago, they'd be the standards now. So I think afatinib, we're waiting to see if it's the right drug to use in not only patients who fail upfront therapies like gefitinib and erlotinib, but should these be the first line treatment agents for patients with activating mutations? So at diagnosis, this is what they get. And so far, none of these have yet been approved or on the market. I think afatinib is probably ahead in terms of its development, but it remains to be seen. The drugs clearly are active. That's been demonstrated over and over again. These drugs have activity. Perhaps even the greatest benefit is in patients with the T790 resistant mutations, patients who once were sensitive to drugs like gefitinib and erlotinib. Perhaps introducing a drug, an irreversible inhibitor, could restore benefit or sensitivity to the tumors with these resistant mutations. But I guess the bottom line is we're not there yet. I think a lot of folks would speculate in the next couple of years, probably one of these drugs will be close to approval.
What about the ARC compound? You know anything about that?
Yeah, so that's the compound we sometimes refer to as the ARQ-197. This is an interesting drug. It's an oral small molecule inhibitor of MET. So if you wanted to talk about the many MET inhibitors that are out there, we've talked about MetMab, and I mentioned crizotinib, which so far has not been really studied in patients with MET, so-called MET-positive tumors. But the ARQ-197 is probably the furthest along, I mean, even ahead of MetMab. So we've heard now, I think, at least two or three presentations. The last I remember was in Chicago at Everett Vokes meeting, where we saw the updated results of a randomized phase 2 study with this compound in combination with erlotinib. So the design of that trial was very similar to the MetMab design, refractory patients randomized to the combination or erlotinib and placebo. The primary endpoint was PFS in this trial. So I think you just have to kind of walk through the results in the same way you look at the MetMab data. So the initial overall intent to treat analysis, as I see it, did not really show a benefit, but an adjusted analysis of the intent to treat population actually favored, for PFS, favored the combination of 197 and erlotinib. Now, pre-planned subset analyses looking at patients with non-squamous tumors actually show that that advantage was even greater, and that was true for PFS and OS. So there's a signal right there. Also, there was an unusual advantage in patients with KRAS mutations, which, you know, really no one has shown to date. So that has led to a randomized phase 3 study that Giorgio Scagliotti is leading, that is a global study where patients are randomized to 197 and erlotinib or erlotinib and placebo. Patients have to have non-squamous tumors to get on that study. So that's the only kind of subsetting, or I guess selection, that's going on at baseline. So that's got an overall survival endpoint. I think the total planned enrollment is near 1,000. So that trial is underway. I think it got underway at the start of the year. And my understanding is it has somewhere under 100 patients on it right now, but enrollment's picking up weekly on that.